Let's get going, shall we? So thanks ever so much for joining us today. For those of you that don't know us, and hopefully most of you do by now, we're MPM Legal, which is we specialise in employment and business immigration, supporting employers not just in the UK but all over the world who have one thing in common, and that's that they employ people in the UK. The usual housekeeping before we start. Please chip in with any questions or comments that you might have. If you can use the Q&A function, that's super helpful to us because then we can manage it better. We won't call you out. We won't turn your cameras on. We won't ask you to speak. So sit back and feel free to type your questions. And as long as they're not too difficult and challenging, we'll see if we can answer them. But I've already agreed with Mark that if there are any difficult questions, he can answer them. But yeah, don't shake your head, Mark. If you are listening to this later on our Spotify or Apple Music channel, then today's date is the 6th of June, just so that you know that what we're talking about is current. And yeah, so today I'm welcomed by my colleague Mark. And for those of you that are used to seeing Peter, he's whizzing around France on two wheels on a little cycling trip. And I hope he's got better weather than we have here.
I
Anyway.
think there's a little cycling trip. I think even though it's a big cycling
Oh, it's
trip.
a massive cycling trip. Yeah. He's a very, very competent cyclist who can sometimes come in the morning and say, "Yeah, I've just done a little spin this morning doing 30, 40 miles." And I'm thinking, crikey, I can do about two if I'm lucky. But anyway, cracking on with today's topic, we're going to talk a little bit about TUPE, or the Transfer of Undertakings Regulations. And it's a bit of a massive topic, and we certainly can't cover everything in one session. So we've tried to tease out some key areas that we think might be useful for you guys to listen to. But if you do have any specific questions or issues that we don't cover today, or you would like a specific session on something a bit more detailed, do drop us a line, as we will happily put on an extra session. Right then, Mark. So what are we starting with?
Well, the start at the beginning, I suppose, which is there a TUPE transfer, or when is there a TUPE transfer, I suppose, is the first question. And it's not always an easy question to answer that. And really, for me, we see them cropping up in all sorts of unlikely places and situations. But fundamentally, we've got two areas that we're thinking about. And first is the traditional transfer of an undertaking, which is simply where you have a sale. An asset sale or purchase where part of a business is being sold off. The second category is a service provision change, which is more commonly known as an outsourcing. Well, let me give you an example of each of those. So for the transfer of an undertaking, you might have a big accountancy practice that may say they're hiving off their audit practice into another accountancy firm, perhaps they're selling it on to another practice. Most likely that would be a transfer of an undertaking. And there are various tests and sub-questions that you have to ask yourself, but it's essentially where part of a business is picked up and sold to another business. So that's example one. The second example is outsourcing, which is what, I don't know about you, Adrian, it's what something I see a lot more of. All the cases I seem to handle seem to be outsourcing related in one form or another. And that's simply where a company moves its, for example, IT help desk, is the example I always give. And they might ask another company to take on their IT help desk support, because it may be that they manufacture widgets or they do something non-IT related, and they want to get a third-party provider to give them economies by taking on their IT help desk activity. And that third party then carries out the activities on behalf of the original company. So that's the second category. And then in that second category, there's a second limb, I suppose, which is what we would call second generation outsourcing, which is where you have a change of provider of the outsourced party. So take a slightly different example where I've seen this happen quite a lot. You might have a company that has a security contract in place with a security company, and they might provide overnight security staff or site security to look after the site and the safety of the people on the site. Periodically, those contracts turn over quite a lot, a bit like cleaning contracts, actually. And it might be that the incumbent provider is replaced by a new provider, because a new security company might come along and provide a different or better or more cost-effective service. That too would be what we call a second-generation outsourcing, because the security staff working in the first company would technically, at least, practically might be different, technically at least, would transfer across to the second company if they're doing the same job. From their perspective, all that might change is the name of the employing entity on their payslip, I've seen that happen lots of times, and it's just the company that employs them changes. The day-to-day work is exactly the same. And in those sorts of contracts, if you're involved in them, you always need to make sure that you've got GP provisions in the contract, because what you've got to watch out for is the incoming provider not having indemnity cover from the outgoing provider and being concerned they might inherit a whole bunch of liabilities that come from the outgoing provider. And I'll talk about that a bit later on. Now, those are the sort of two and a half areas we need to think about. But the practical question I always ask when we get a call about workforce changes, and often these are characterized as a restructure or a redundancy. My client will ring and they'll say, look, we're changing things around. We don't think we need this activity anymore here, and we'll expect the staff redundant. Always ask the question, well, what's happening to the work? Because if the work is stopping, i.e. we're no longer making widgets, that's one thing. But if the answer actually is, oh yeah, we're moving the widget manufacturer to another company in a different part of the country, or even another company overseas, they could both be GP transfers. And that often gets missed. And for reasons we'll talk about later, you end up in the same place. But what you miss is the consultation obligations that you have under a GP, if it is properly a GP, and you mischaracterize it as a redundancy process. So you do need to make sure you follow the correct consultation approach.
Yeah, I think that's really important, isn't it? It's remembering that the employees may not be your employees anymore because you don't need them, but they have the right to follow the work. Is essentially it. I mean, this is something that comes up quite a lot. You mentioned cleaning companies, and I've had, less so recently, but certainly in the past, there have been conversations with our cleaning company is rubbish. We're going to find a new provider. And then they're dismayed that when they realize they might get a new provider, so they're paying invoices to a new company, but they get exactly the same cleaning staff as they've had before, because all of those cleaning staff have simply transferred from one company to another. So you're relying really on the new provider just being better at managing the existing staff. But yeah, if you think that the standard of cleaning is awful, then just be ready for the fact that you could end up with the same people doing the same cleaning and at the same awful standard, unless you can really stand on your new provider. But anyway, that's a conversation. What about share sales? So we often get asked, you know, but we're selling the business, and obviously our first question is it an asset sale, or is it a sale of the shares? And the difference is here is that with an asset sale, you're talking about selling the goodwill of the business. So you're taking the business out from underneath the ownership, if you like, under the sort of like the framework, which is the legal entity. Whereas in a share sale, you're selling the ownership behind the scenes. So the business stays the same, the company stays the same, but it's just the ownership behind it. And TUPE itself does not apply to a share sale, because the employees aren't changing employers. They stay in exactly the same place. As I said, it's the ownership behind the scenes. But that's not always the end of the story, and there are potential pitfalls. So if ever you're involved in, your company, say, for example, acquiring another company's shares so that there'll be two companies sitting alongside each other, there may well be steps that the organization as a whole wants to take to kind of streamline the operations across it. So it may well be that certain functions will stop. So for example, you might typically have two finance teams, one in one company and one in the company that's just being acquired, but you don't need both. And so what could happen, for example, you've got your company, let's call it Joe Blogs Limited, because I'm that creative in coming up with names. It buys the shares of James Smith Limited, again, so creative. And it's decided that actually we don't really need the finance team of Jane Smith, because it can all be handled by Joe Blogs Limited's finance team. So you then go, all right, well, we'll make redundancies in Jane Smith because we don't need those people anymore. But that comes back to the question that Mark, you've just said, which is, well, what's happening to the work? Who's looking after the finance function of Jane Smith? So the answer to that will be, well, it'll be the finance team at Joe Blogs. And that potentially is where you can forget that is a transfer of a function from one company to another. I mean, there's loads of tests and questions around it, but essentially that's what you've got to be alive to.
Yeah, and there's a related point there, actually, which is where you've got one company acquires the shares in another company, and on the face of it, they're operating independently. But if the company that's been acquired is effectively being run by the other company, the operating mind of it, if you like, is in the original company, then there's a tubi situation potentially there post the share sale. So just the practical point is just be careful. If you're involved in an acquisition of, and it's a share sale, just think forwards about, well, how's that new company that we've acquired going to be managed in future? Is it completely arm's length? In which case, fine. The greater the degree to which it's being managed by the existing company, the greater the risk that we've got GP starting to creep in at some point.
So why is all of this stuff important from an HR perspective? I mean, legally speaking, then, you've got to be alive to it. But as HR, you're probably going to be involved in information and consultation, which I'm sure you're all aware of. So you're probably going to end up running the consultation process.
Yeah, and it's, well, as we know, there is a TUPE consultation obligation in the event of a TUPE transfer. And as with collective redundancy, that involves consulting with a union if you have one, standing body of employee reps if you have one. And if you don't have either of those things, then employee reps have got to be elected in a specific way. Very much the same as a collective redundancy process. And do make sure, if you've got a standing body of employee reps, do make sure that they're elected or appointed for the purposes of TUPE specifically. Because sometimes they're not elected for any purpose. Maybe they'll be a sort of social committee rather than a what we call hard-edged consultation committee. But if they've only been elected for redundancy purposes, they won't have the standing to run a TUPE consultation process. So you need to make sure they're appointed for that purpose too. The process itself is much the same as collective redundancy in terms of how you interact. But generally, my experience has been it's much simpler and shorter, and less contentious most of the time, actually. But there's less to talk about than would be in a formal collective redundancy situation. Now, there are some changes coming up here for smaller organizations and organizations with fewer people that are going to be caught by TUPE. So the need to consult with representatives that we just spoke about. Doesn't apply to businesses with fewer than 10 staff. That's the current position as of today. You would still have to consult with the affected employees themselves, but you wouldn't have to consult with reps. Now, from the 1st of July, that exclusion is going to expand, and it's going to apply to businesses with fewer than 50 employees, or for any size of employer, if transfer is relating to fewer than 10 employees. So two different categories. If you've got 50 employees or fewer, you're okay. But if you've got 10 employees transferring or fewer, you are okay in terms of rep consultation. Now, while you might be able to dispense with the need to consult with reps and go through that whole election and nomination process, it can be quite time consuming, you do still need to speak to the employees. Or if you've already got reps from trade union in place, you do still have to consult with them. So you can't use these new rules to circumvent your existing relationships you might have with unions or with standing bodies of reps. And you might breathe a sigh of relief with this, but actually, my view of it is it's very similar to the position that we take these days in relation to redundancy exercises. And certainly, at the start of my career, I spent a lot of time dealing with cases where we'd make 19 people redundant because we didn't want to go into collective redundancy consultation. And in this case, the numbers are bigger. So you could have 49 employees that could be involved, and you might be entitled to consult them individually, but that's going to be a real faff and a hassle because they're all going to have different questions and all things to raise that they're going to want to raise. Far better, I think, to do it via reps in those sorts of situations. That's a question to be answered perhaps down the road, but I wouldn't assume that it's easier necessarily under these new rules. So once you've established that you're going to consult, the next thing you need to ask yourself is, well, who are you going to consult with? And if you're the outgoing employer, you consult with the affected staff. Normally, from my experience, has almost exclusively been this, which isn't exactly correct, is that we only consult with the people that are transferring. So you have a body of people that are transferring out for whatever reason, whether it's a transfer of an undertaking or an outsourcing, you only consult with them. But strictly, the rules are much wider than that. And they say you should consult with affected employees. It could be that there are some affected employees at the transferor, the original company, who are not transferring yet. And conversely, there could be affected employees on the transferee side as a result of the inbound employees. Now, I've never had to consult with those other two groups. Have you, Adrian?
No, it's never come up. No.
And I've never had an issue with it. And I've always thought I might, actually, because especially in environments where they might have a union or might have employee reps that have been through these processes before, and we'll talk later about the consequences and the failure to consult properly. But it might just be one of those things that keep lawyers awake at night, but normal people don't actually care too much, because if you are, you know, affected not in a significant manner by the GP, maybe you just get on with your job.
Does that mean we're not normal? Just asking.
Well, speak for yourself. we don't want to say. yes, so it's a minefield, I'm afraid.
Yeah. I mean, so for example, if you've got going back to look our little finance example, you might bring in a group of people into a finance team and then have to do a post-transfer redundancy. So that you're then technically meant to look at your combined teams. So you can't just cherry pick the people that are transferred. So that means that your existing employees in the finance team are going to be impacted by the transfer, because they could be thrown into a redundancy process. So there is that potential scope there for them to say, well, hang on a minute, we count as affected employees as a result of the transfer, even though we ourselves haven't transferred and you haven't consulted with us. So that's I think that's something. But as you say, I've never really seen it, but it is a minefield for sure.
And we'll talk in a minute about the awards that can be made. But your risk is, if you get a finding of a failure to consult properly, it can suddenly affect a whole group of people that weren't otherwise involved and really broaden out the liability that you have to face.
Yeah. Let's talk about another situation often comes up, particularly if you work for a company that is very acquisitive and you end up with a sort of a whole mishmash of acquisitions and people coming in, people coming out. Everybody's like super keen to harmonise terms and conditions. And I'm sure you'll have all heard that term of harmonisation. We all know that getting everybody onto the same T's and C's and on the same level of benefits is the dream, because obviously from an admin perspective, working out what things like pension contributions are, holiday entitlements, can be a total nightmare. And certainly one of the things that we found is that the sort of tech systems, HR tech systems that are in place, are often not necessarily geared up to have significant differences across these entitlements. So it does become quite tricky. But Tupi, being as it is, doesn't make it easy for you. And the basic rule, as you know, is that employees transfer on their existing terms and conditions to the new employer, so the new employer stands in the shoes as if they were the original employer. And you are only able to change terms and conditions if it's for an ETO reason. What's this? Well, ETO is an economic, technical, or organisational reason entailing changes in the workforce. And this entire mouthful is important. There must be changes in the workforce. And frankly, that usually means some kind of restructure, some kind of redundancy, but can also mean things like a change of workplace location. So that's a change in the workforce. And only in that situation are you able to make changes to those T's and C's. Now, the risk of harmonising when there's no ETO reason, even if the employees are like, yeah, of course, I'll sign your terms, and you think it's all fine and dandy. The problem is that at any point in the future, and it is unlimited, the employee can argue that the changes that they agreed to way back when are void, because they were made in connection with a transfer, which is not permitted. And as you can imagine, this is not normally something that comes up when the relationship between you and your employee is good. It comes up at the point when you fall out. And things like notice periods, and in particular, post-termination restrictions, can all come under the microscope. And in fact, if we get an individual coming to us saying, do you think my post-termination restrictions are enforceable? Asking whether or not they've ever been part of a TUPE transfer is one of the key questions that we ask up front, just to see if that's a point of attack. Because it will basically mean that if your contract is void, you won't be able to rely on the post-termination restrictions that are in the new terms that they signed up to. So you've got to be a bit wary about how you deal with this. And to be frank, it's a bigger topic, so I'm not going to cover the nuts and bolts of how you go about doing it, save to say that there's one tip that you can do. And if you promote somebody or you change their job after the transfer, you know, just in the natural life cycle of the employees, then I would recommend that at that point, that's a trigger for you to issue a new contract, because that's absolutely fine. That change is not then in connection with a transfer. It's related to that particular individual's change of employment.
And a couple of follow-on points for me. What I've seen happen a few times, I'm not sure this works, is the new employer will say, well, we'll give you these benefits that are better than your other benefits, but you forego your old benefits. You only get the new benefits if you don't assert a claim for the old benefits. But that, to me, just seems doomed to failure. And I've seen it happen a few times, because you're essentially just trying to circumnavigate the whole effective tube fee.
Yeah.
Which takes me on to the second point, particularly in relation to insured benefits. So remember, you're standing in the shoes of the original employer. If that employer has in place a very generous medical expenses insurance policy, for example, and the employee transfers with that, and you don't have that insured, you could find yourself in a position where the employee is saying, well, I had that benefit before, I now need to go to this hospital treatment, which is going to cost thousands of pounds. You failed to bring my terms over and insure me properly, so you've got to pay for that. So the due diligence exercise is really key before any transfer of, well, what exactly are we getting ourselves into here with the employees? And that will all come out during the process, if it's a corporate transaction process with the lawyers, because you'll get a due diligence report which will set out exactly what you're inheriting. But it's really important to get into the weeds of exactly what that is, and then making sure that what you've been told as to what you're getting for employee benefits and their terms is captured in the legal agreement that you might have with the company that you are doing the deal with. Make sure you've really got it buttoned down nice and tight.
Just to add on to that one, is permanent health insurance is another one like that.
Yeah.
So your long-term disability insurance, and that can be like a massively expensive claim if an employee is entitled to it, but you don't have a policy in place, because yeah. Those are the policies that pay, I don't know, 66% or 75% of salary, sometimes until retirement. So you can imagine a failure to put in place that type of policy when an employee has one could be super expensive.
Great. So I had a question through, which is, and this is going back a couple of steps, but Adrian's creative companies. So
thanks.
If of the two companies, Joe Bloggs Limited and Jane Smith Limited, one is unionised and one is not, the impact of moving functions from one to the other could impact lots of people, not just those who are being transferred. Is this correct? Yes, it is, because it's not just the transferring group who could be affected by the transfer. And as I think Adrian said earlier, take the transferee company, you could have inbound a whole bunch of people who might be duplicating activities that are currently being performed at the transferee, and that might result in some of them being made redundant. So yeah, it could impact them.
Yeah.
Which rather neatly takes me on to my next question, actually, almost as if we planned this, Adrian, which is, well, what about redundancies? Because very often, post-TUPE, there will need to be some changes. And that normally takes the form of redundancies. And the key thing to remember is the redundancy doesn't sit with the transferor. The redundancy sits in the transferee, because the transferee would be the company that has too many people post the transfer. Now, that happens in a fairly straightforward way, where you've got a company that acquires another company, it's duplicate. But we also see it in outsourcing of activities. So you mentioned the second type of cheapie, which is an outsourcing. And that happens very typically where you have an outsourcing of IT activities overseas. And of course, the outsourced provider isn't going to set up a UK workplace or a UK entity. So that creates a redundancy situation. It also creates a lot of confusion for everybody, because if you say to the existing IT help desk function that your activity is being moved to India, or more glamorously, as I have once, to Mauritius, the employees seem to always say, well, I don't want to move to India or Mauritius, I like it in this country. And there's always this misunderstanding of what it actually means. And it doesn't mean that their employment and they have to move with their job. It just means they become employed by an entity in an overseas jurisdiction that will probably make them redundant. And they would be the ones that would have to carry out the consultation process. Now, this normally creates quite a bit of confusion, as I say, and there's really a couple of ways to try and deal with it. If we carry on with the IT help desk example, the transferee, the IT help desk company, they could have an agreement to do a pre-transfer consultation process with you, with the transferor. So in the build-up to the transfer date, there's been a whole bunch of consultations gone on where they've explained that they might not need these employees, so that the period immediately post-transfer is as short as possible and the transferee doesn't have to pay those staff on an ongoing basis. Because the commercial point that we need to keep in mind here is, if you're saying to a new outsourced partner, you're going to have to inherit some of our staff and make them redundant, well, they're not going to do that out of the goodness of their heart, and they're going to want to pass that cost on to you. And that can be done in lots of different ways. You might have an open-ended indemnity cost in your agreement with them, or it may be that you agree a fixed budget to allow them to make these individuals redundant post the transfer date. That's always, for me anyway, a bit unsatisfactory and messy, because my experience anyway has been the transferee company, particularly if they're overseas, are just not very interested in this. And it might be we're talking about employees that have been with you for a long time that you want to look after. So the approach I generally suggest to clients is, well, let's try and create a situation where the narrative is something like, there are two options here. One is you could transfer and you'll get the minimum statutory redundancy pay, and you'll have to work your notice period. Now that's one option for you, but because we're such a good employer, we want to look after you and we want to do a deal with you whereby you sign a release of claims, so a settlement agreement, prior to the transfer date, and we'll give you some extra money. And in all of the cases I've done, I can't think of a single one actually where the employee has not agreed to that, because they have that simple choice: transfer to a company I don't know, who may or may not ever pay me, or do a deal with my existing employer where I get more money under a settlement agreement, and my employment ends prior to the transfer date, so I don't transfer across to the transferee company. And that would be a tripartite settlement agreement, by the way. So it would be employee, transferor, and transferee wrapping up all the different claims that might exist. And that's the most practical way, I think, for dealing with employees that are no longer required in the context of the TUPE.
Well, that brings us on neatly to what are the possible claims when it goes wrong? Because obviously, the minute you offer a settlement agreement, then potentially the employee is into trying to negotiate with you to try and pick holes in your process to see if you've done anything wrong with a view to getting some more cash. So let's use that as a neat segue into looking at potential claims. Well, firstly, any dismissals in connection with the transfer are automatically unfair. I think a point worth noting that certainly at this particular moment in time, employees will still need 2 years service to bring that claim. Following what is undoubtedly looking like a change of government, however, bear in mind that the service requirement of 2 years is something that is going to be looked at. So we need to be really careful of that, because as we know, a Labour government, if they get in, are going to make it a day one right. Secondly, and on top of any claims for unfair dismissal, a failure to inform and consult under TUPE can lead to a protective award of up to 13 weeks actual pay per employee. Now, I had many, many years ago, when I was a very junior lawyer, I remember being pulled into a corporate deal late one night where the corporate team had kind of overlooked TUPE. And they were at that point when they were all poring over the documents at 3 a.m. doing what corporate lawyers do. And they went, I was going to say a rude word then, but damn, we forgot about TUPE. Not me, surely not me. We forgot about TUPE. And it was like, yeah, you do have to consult with the staff. And the seller of the business, who was fairly robust, shall we say, went slightly mad. And I was asked to speak to him on the phone. And he said to me, what's all this TUPE nonsense? Do we really have to elect reps and go and speak to the staff at this late stage? Can we just ignore it? And I'm like, yeah, of course you can. Absolutely no issue at all, but just get your checkbook out and start writing checks for up to 13 weeks pay per employee. And it's actual pay. It's not capped like redundancy payments. It's their actual weekly pay, at which point it was like, yeah, I don't really want to do that. So they rolled back and they did do a consultation process. So 13 weeks actual pay is the starting point. And we often get asked, how do tribunals assess where to be? Well, if there's a blatant disregard and a blatant failure, then you're looking at the maximum. And the tribunals basically start there and work backwards and look at any mitigating circumstances or whether any efforts were made. So it's a pretty hefty lump sum. But then equally, just to add insult to injury, if as a result of transfer, there's likely to be redundancies of 20 or more, Oh, sorry. I probably just should just say, first of all, that the failure to inform consult is a joint obligation and joint liability on both the original employer and the new one. So the if you're the new employer and you're on the hook for a failure to inform and consult, then add to that any post-transfer redundancies affecting 20 or more and you haven't gone through a collective process, there's then a second protective award potentially of up to 90 days pay. So 90 days, 13 weeks, both about the same, but you're looking at double bubble potentially on that for two different claims. So that's why it's even more important to make sure that you're ahead of the game and you're looking at that particular process. Obviously, because it would make a settlement agreement slightly more expensive than you might have planned.
Okay. All right, so a few takeaways then for you at the end here. And really, I think the main point in all of this is one point you made earlier, which is just be alive in any kind of reorganization or organizational change that you're making. Just step back and think, could there be a cheaper angle here? Because obviously, like all these things, it's far better to catch it early and plan for it and have to deal with corporate laws at 3 a.m. as Adrian was having to do. And it's planning, like always with these things. And if you're the transferor or the prospective transferor, think about who's in scope and why. Check there's no one missing. So it could be somebody on sick leave, maternity absence, whatever it is. Make sure you know who your pool of transferring employees are. And you know what their terms and conditions are, because of course that will have to be shared with the transferee as part of your employer liability information pack that you'll have to send across. Think too about the amount of reps that you'll need who have a standing body. We spoke earlier about the changing rules for some companies there, but don't dismiss the idea of reps out of hand. You know, we have some clients that regard reps as always being difficult and hard to work with and sort of trade union-esque. But my experience, almost exclusively actually, in any consultation I've done with reps that we've appointed, has been overwhelmingly positive. So I always encourage clients to consider using reps where they can.
But also, I mean, I've also had situations where everybody's so busy focused on who the employee reps are and getting the elections right and all of that good stuff that nobody's actually given any thought to who's going to run the consultation meetings on the management side. So you've got the decision makers and you as HR are probably going to step in and help run the process. But who from management is going to sit in and be on the other side of the table, so to speak, from the reps? So it's worthwhile doing that. And for both parties, both the employee reps and the management side, having enough fundamental understanding of what TUPE means and what your obligations are in consultation is really important. And I know for a fact, you know, we've done a lot of training for employee reps so they understand their role, but it's just as important for management to understand their role. So having some form of training or agenda, that type of stuff, so they know what they're talking about is really, really critical. Getting the information from the new employer. So the new employer is obliged to tell you what measures it's proposing to take. So you will often hear the phrase of, well, have we sent the measures letter? The measures letter is just going to be setting out where there may well be changes post-transfer. And I know we've talked about not changing T's and C's, but, you know, things like pension providers are going to change, or, you know, our payroll dates are going to change, you know, right up to workplaces are going to change. We're going to move from a workplace to a hybrid situation, that type of stuff. So you need to get all of that information, or provide it if you're the new employer, to the original employer, because that's what they need to talk to their employees about. So start your consultation on time. There's no time limit. So, if, you know, for those of you that have been involved in collective redundancies, you all know that if it's 20 or more, it's a minimum period of 30 days. There's no such time limit on TUPE, which is makes it a bit more difficult, but and sometimes leads to, well, let's leave it to the last minute. But it does all the timing says, all it says about timing in the legislation is that it needs to be in good time, which basically means far enough ahead of the transfer to enable a true dialogue to take place. You know, it is a consultation process after all. You are trying to reach agreement. It's not just a question of here's the information, crack on with it. Or rather, if there are any changes, it's not just a question of here's the information, because if there are no changes, it's going to be a lot easier. Think about how redundancies are going to be handled. Mark's talked about how you can possibly handle them before, but if they're going to be handled after, then you'll need that information from the new employer. How many will there be? What's your consultation obligations? Will you offer enhanced packages and how?
And I've got a few sort of practical points to add on to the end of that, which, well, the first one is, if you're seeing any of your commercial teams agreeing contracts that could involve staff moving. You really need to see those contracts and get involved in what's included in them. Very often they just don't include GP at all, especially outsourcing contracts. And there are all sorts of, and it's not time to go into it now, but all sorts of provisions you need to have in there, like who carries the liability for consultation, who's responsible for paying up until what point, how do we deal with one of the tricks that sometimes happens to Adrienne's point earlier, which is if a, let's say a cleaning company, and I don't want to impugn any cleaning companies, but if a cleaning company is told we're terminating your contract in 3 months, what sometimes happens is they might move out their good staff from that contract and bring in other staff so that they are the ones that are in scope. And that was once colloquially described to me as stuffing. So I was trying to get that phrase into any kind of cheapy talk that I do. So you're just left with the staff that you don't want. And conversely, on the employees, on the transferee side, what happens when employees pop up that nobody was expecting to transfer or perhaps were forgotten? And again, colloquially known as woodwork employees. So you need to figure out what do we do with those? And they all have to go into the T's and C's. And as I say, we could speak for an hour about what you should include in a contract from a chief perspective, but take care and perhaps take advice on what should be included.
Yeah. Very often in those contracts, you see things like here's a key team, and they're all named, and there's a bit in the contract which says the key team will not be changed in the last 12 months of the contract, for example. Yeah. So it's being alive to that type of thing. If there's a fast one being pulled, then it's something that can be challenged.
Yeah. And then what happens? I mean, I had a case a few years ago now where there was a dispute about whether GP applied. So it was a catering company provided hot and cold catering services to this factory. They got terminated. And the new catering company was only providing cold catering services to the factory. There was a big dispute because the transferor said the employees are transferred to the transferee. The transferee said no, they haven't, because we're providing a different service. And what then happens? The employee sues both of them. So you both end up in the employment tribunal, and the judge tries to figure out which way to deal with it. And the test is essentially, is the activity fundamentally or essentially the same post the transfer as opposed to before the transfer? In that case, the whole analysis was around whether this was catering services in the highest sense, or whether there was a difference between hot and cold catering and cold catering. And that involved all sorts of analysis about the difference between sandwiches and spaghetti bolognese and all this sort of stuff. But it is worth just thinking that's where you can end up if it doesn't go well. And the final one for me is a small one, but which we've seen quite a bit, is if you have an intra-group GP transfer. So it might be just a purely administrative change. And it could be something as simple as you could change from one type of company to another type of company. Very often clients will say, well, we don't want to go through the whole rep process with employees for that, because it's a real rigmarole. In fact, this happened in a law firm I worked in many years ago. They changed from one type of structure to another. GP was engaged, but all they did was they wrote to all of us and said, we think this is a GP transfer. Here's the information you would be given if we were to elect reps. Let us know if you have any questions. So they broadly complied, although not technically, but they did enough to satisfy everybody and nobody raised an issue. So there is a shortcut that you can sometimes take in these intra-group non-contentious type of restructures as well.
Mm. Great. Okay. So whistle-stop tour through some of the points of GP. Again, if there's anything burning that you think, oh, they didn't cover this, please drop us a line and let us know.
Yeah, that's
nice. And we will absolutely cover it. So all that's left is for me to say thank you for joining us today. As before, if you want to listen to this again, or you want your team members to listen to it, do take a look at our Spotify channel, MPM Legal Employment Law 101. I think it's on Apple Music as well. Peter sometimes refers to Amazon Music. I don't know. But it's also going to be posted up on our website in a few days once our guys have worked their magic. So we will see you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you all for joining.
Thanks a lot. Enjoy your day.
All right. Bye-bye.